I have no idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Clark, you have a delete everything amendment?
I do. Would you like to take care of that first, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the order that the author desires. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
We do have it, right?
Yes.
Yes. So members, we're working off of the delete everything A1 amendment. Senator Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an issue that's actually been in front of us for quite a long time. And that is, we've got two parts of this. The main part of it is kind of the timing of special elections. And I may be in the only district that has elected the last two state senators between Christmas and New Year's, but such it is. Senator Kleist got elected on December 28th in 1994, and I was elected on December 27th in 2005. And a number of other people have been elected right around holidays as well. Both Senator Koch and Senator Bonifacio are on this bill. They both were elected 2 days before Thanksgiving. And part of the intent here is to take away some of the politicization in the process, but also let our families focus on holidays instead of trying to figure out what's going on with candidates. And that's been an ongoing issue. Very briefly about, from my perspective, about what happened in our election, and we have levels here to talk about it from a county standpoint. But our election was called for Tuesday, December 27th. Christmas happened to be on Sunday. First day of Hanukkah happened to be Monday. Friday was a holiday. All the offices were closed. Nobody could go vote. Saturday had to be open, Christmas Eve, in three counties, even though we had next to nobody voting. We had Sunday, which was Christmas. Monday was a federal holiday, and Tuesday was our election. Well, what it meant was is people were getting, instead of Christmas cards and other kinds of holiday related things in the mail, they were getting loads of campaign literature. And that's not really the way you want people to be spending their holidays. And frankly, I think we want the public to be able, our voters, to be able to focus on what the candidates are saying and making good decisions. All three of us who were elected last year under the special election circumstances really do believe that that's been a burden on the public. In addition, in our case, as you may imagine, our churches and our schools were not intending on being open between Christmas and New Year's. They all had to be open because that's where our polling places are. So it brought extra costs, it brought extra burdens, and so this bill tries to rectify that. The Delete Everything amendment, in part, clarifies kind of the dates around which, basically, we're saying within 5 days either side of a holiday. We think that that would actually do it, but still give a governor the flexibility to call it. I'm sorry, Senator Rest. I was going to say, and Mr. Schreifels could talk a bit more about both that from a county perspective, but also what the rest of the bill does.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, was comfortable in the original language when you in the bill that says around a state holiday, because I think there's a common understanding of that. But as I'm looking just very quickly on the delete everything, you just now say held on a holiday or within 5 days before or after a holiday, and I'm trying to find where you define holiday, because
yep.
I mean, if it's religious holidays, there might be some religions that have a holiday on any given day.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, perhaps Council Watson can talk a little bit about this, but we have the definition, the statutory definition, within your packet. Ironically, when I was preparing for today, I actually asked the exact same question, and he reminded me that we actually have a statutory definition.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder then if we could have an amendment, Mr. Watson, that references this section of statute, just to be clear.
Mr. Watson.
So wherever it would say it would be held on a holiday as defined in 645-44 subdivision 5, just by reference. I think that would you would stop getting that question.
Mr. Chair, it's our rest. I think that's an excellent idea.
Mr. Chairman, I move that amendment that on line 2.35, insert after holiday.
As defined in section
645.44, subdivision 5.
Everybody have that? Senator Rest's motion is before us. Are there any questions?
Just whether it makes a difference whether it's before the first or after the first or second holiday.
Senator Rest. Or Mr. Watson, maybe you can provide us guidance.
I think I might be inclined to just put it before the period, so it's not breaking up the sentence.
Yes. So it would be after the second holiday. I would change my motion before the period.
All right. Does everyone have Senator Rest's motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Are there further questions for Senator Clark? Senator Clark, you have some testimony. If we could
if we could
be as brief as possible.
Yes.
For it or against it?
Just in general, the bill, besides changing that holiday language.
And could you state your name for the record, please?
Randy Schweitzer. I'm the Stearns County Auditor Treasurer. The bill does a number of things, and Senator Clark, in her election, was in 2005, and that was before the HAVA changes. And the HAVA changes now have some additional requirements, such as the voting machine and the program that's required for that. So what this bill also does is provide a little more time to get some of that additional work done. It also clarifies some of the questionable or things that are not clear when running a special election. That we ran into in running a number of special elections. So the county auditors have seen the bill and have signed off on it, and the Secretary of State also approved it. So.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Mr. Manske?
Mr. Chairman, Joe Manske, and actually I'm just here speaking for the county auditors, and we are in support of this, I think, because we all occasionally have special elections to fill vacancies in the legislature. And again, speaking from personal experience, when the election is between, especially the ones that are between Christmas and New Year's, the schools are closed, people are out of town, it's difficult to get election judges. It's just very disruptive, not only to the voters, but for those of us who have to conduct the election.
Thank you, Mr. Manske. Senator Rest.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate file, unless there's anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify.
Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 1366 be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 1366 be recommended to pass, as amended.
As amended.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. On my copy, on line 2.19, I've written in before primary special. So it says during the 7 days before a special primary or special election. What I don't know is whether the copies you have the special in there.
No.
No.
I think it should be special primary or special election.
Yeah.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I would make that motion as an amendment.
Senator Rest moves it on line 2.19 that special be inserted.
Before primary.
Before primary.
And I believe on the other... in line 210, it is there.
It's there.
And line 234.
It's there.
It's there. Special primary on 33 is there. And I think that's the only places.
317
is there. And everyone have that. Senator Rest's motion is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 1366 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 1366 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Clark. Senator Olsen. Members, before we take up Senator Olsen's bill, Has everyone had a chance to review the minutes? Senator Gerlach moves to approve the minutes from Wednesday, March 7th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
I am the only one voting.
You're very successful, Senator Ross. Senator Olsen, Senate File 1350.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm happy to be before you tonight. I've got a bill, Senate File 1350, that came about because of a school bond referendum election in my district that failed in November. And somebody was astute enough to read that with a petition of 50 voters, they could call for a special election, or the school board would have to call for a special election. So on line 1.13, there's a simple fix to this concern, and the sentence reads, before that is, upon petition of 50 or more voters of the school district or 5% of the number of voters voting at the preceding regular school district election. So we just put in whichever is greater, because it's kind of something that I think got forgotten, and so I believe it's a simple fix, and I'm asking you guys to look into this.
Are there questions for Senator Olsen? Is there anyone in the public that would like to testify? Mr. Deans.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. This is the way that in the past that we've interpreted this statute. It's what we have in our handbook, but when you read it, it's clear that it somewhere when this thing was going through, when that second requirement got added in, part of the language got dropped off in a conference committee or something somewhere throughout the way. It doesn't make sense to say it, to have both requirements in there and not know which one applies. Now that I look at this, though, I wonder if we say the preceding regular school district election, I wonder if that should say general election, because I think that's what you mean. That's the regular election, unless everyone's happy that regular election means the general election.
Mr. Watson, can you tell us what is our best course of action there?
Mr. Chairman, to be consistent with the way we usually describe these, wouldn't we strike regular and insert general after district?
Yes. So that we're clear as to which election we're running.
On line, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watson, Mr. Deans, on line 116, we talk about a school district general election. So we might as well look at is there any other reference to a either regular or general election other than on line 112. We have general election on 116 and again on 118 and 120. It looks like that's the only place where it is not.
So
Mr. Chairman, I would move to amend Senate File 1350 on line 12 to strike regular and insert general.
And Senator Rest, would we
before election
insert general before election?
Before election to strike regular and insert general before election.
Does everyone have that? Senator Rest's motion is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? No. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I would move that Senate File 1350 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 1350 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify further? Senator Rest's motion is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you.
Senator Olsen. Senator Torres-Ray. Perfect timing.
Thank you.
Senate File 1651.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I am here to ask for your support for Senate File 1651, which will require the translation of voting materials into languages other than English. And I am glad that I have this opportunity to speak before the committee. As you know, I was campaigning for almost a year and door-knocking every day and trying to get as many people as I can out and educated about the voting process. And what I learned through the process was that a lot of the people who were elderly, who were citizens of this country but were not born here, didn't speak the language well enough to really understand the voting process. And particularly, I was having trouble because there were so many people running for office this year, as you know. And we were trying to get a lot of the African community, some of the immigrant community out. And many people, when I came to the door, particularly elderly people, said, well, you know, thank you for coming, but I'm going to vote for Representative Ellison because I already made my decision. And I said, well, I am not running for Congress. I'm not running for the House of Representatives in the U.S. House. I am running for the Senate in the state. And they went like, what? So I thought, so are you running against him or are you not? So they were very confused, and I finally convinced my district that we needed to develop a ballot that we can present and show all the candidates that were running for office. And so we spent a lot of time in my district explaining, you know, what a ballot is and who were the people who were running for office. And we did this in a bipartisan way because we felt that it was important that everybody know about all the candidates, and that is one of the reasons I'm here to ask for your support for this legislation, because I think this is particularly important for refugees and people who have been here under asylum, who got their citizen status in place long before they were able to really speak the language fluently enough to understand the voting process. And so during my campaign, we did a lot of work to translate, but, you know, we had to pay for it. And I, of course, didn't have enough money to translate, but only into one language. And we talked to other candidates to translate into another language, other languages. But I think this is really an important part of our process to build true democracy. And I am here to ask for your support.
Senator Rest.
Reading what it is and how that process would work. You're not asking for the ballot to be printed in other languages, just the instructions and accompanying voting materials. Is that correct? And I'm not sure whether we print the ballot in other languages now anyway. Do we? I don't know that.
I don't know that either.
Mr. Watson, do we print the ballot in other languages? Mr. Mansky says.
Not the ballot, the voter registration card.
The voter registration card, but the ballot is only in English. Is that correct? Okay. Just trying to figure out where it is we have that. Senator Torrey's right. The state demographer currently, according to this, recommends to the Secretary of State languages that there would, it's a fairly vague standard, but nevertheless, where the state demographer feels that the languages would warrant translations of these voting materials. Is that, Mr. Chairman, is that correct?
Senator Torres-Ray.
My understanding is that there is, you know, some language in there, but there is a lot of inconsistency. And, you know, when, as all of you know, during campaigning process, you know, the priorities that are before the office are multiple. And so sometimes they do translate it. Some they translate it for certain people, certain things are translated into some languages. I understand that in the past we did some translation into multiple languages that are no longer needed. German, I think, was one of the languages. Some other languages, I think Senator Marty will talk about that when he comes before you, but we no longer need those languages. So now mm-hmm. we're in need of Somali, particularly, mm-hmm. mostly from people who come here as refugees is the big need. Some people have had, you know, some confusion about Spanish because we have a large Hispanic population in the state of Minnesota. But those who become citizens first are mostly refugees and people who come here under asylum. And they are not necessarily all Latinos. They are from multiple countries, Russia, Somalia, and Ethiopia and other countries throughout the world. So,
Mr. Chairman, so the process is that the state demographer, determines which languages it would be appropriate to provide these materials in. And then, secondly, the Secretary of State produces those materials. And then and has them available. And then the county auditor determines, as a third step, the precincts where there would be, where he or she thinks that those materials would be helpful. Then the Secretary of State supplies them, and then the county auditor puts up a poster saying that they're are available. Is that the process that you are envisioning?
Correct. Yes. Okay. Because some counties, you know,
I'm just trying
don't
to,
need this.
I'm
so
just trying to follow it through of what would actually be happening there.
Absolutely. Okay. So the intent here is that we will support those districts and those areas where we have the need so that we don't impose this, you know, on counties that really don't have the population.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres, right there, there obviously is some fiscal impact on this, but that would be a matter for the Finance Committee to determine rather than the Policy Committee. So we don't have a fiscal note in front of us.
Mr. Watson, is it as I look at line 17 on page 1, and we have the blank, is that, and presumably the county auditor or the
will fill
that in, but is this a typical way of us providing that without direction, that is what in fact will take place?
Mr. Chairman, it is a form with the blank to fill in, and when we put forms in the statutes, we do leave blanks.
Exactly that. Thank you, Mr. Watson. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Torres, right, certainly language can be a barrier to civic participation. I see what you're trying to get at. But my question is, and I hope it's not an ignorant one, but if people are having to prepare materials for the voting process, how do these voters gather up enough material and information to know what they're voting on? I mean, as far as the campaign materials, the issues, all those sorts of things. I would think the barrier would be much earlier on the front end there than the actual voting procedure. But in your experience, how does that play out? Is that a stupid question or
no?
Senator Torres-Ray.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, and Senator Gerlach. Actually, that was a lesson that I learned during this campaigning process that I went through. I thought that people who really were intending to vote really knew the language well enough and they knew what they were doing. You know? And what I found out is that when you're excited about a person, you will go vote regardless of what you know about the process. That's what I found out. And in my district, there were a lot of people who didn't speak the language who were very excited about me just because I was the first Latina. There were a lot of people who were very excited about our representative, Keith Ellison, just because of his faith. But they had no idea of the process. And that was what became for me kind of a more civic campaign, saying, you know, this is how the process works. It is about, I really appreciate that you're supporting me, and I appreciate that you're supporting Keith. But you need to know that these are the offices that you need to vote for. There are two people running for governor. There are these people running for Senate. These are what, and we did a lot of, you know, really a lot of training in the field. And that's what motivated me to really to accept this, because I think it's not enough just to know that they like you and they're going to go vote for you, really without knowing what you're going to be doing here, and not even knowing, you know, that they were voting for a senator here. They didn't know that there was a Senate and the House. There are two bodies, and we have the governor, and so this whole process, I think, was very important. And so my hope is that through this process, we teach more than just, you know, this is a candidate, and you should go for this candidate, because I don't think that's true democracy. I think we should really try to teach people who come to this country to learn about our democracy and how well it works and what the parties do and what the different offices do and what are the responsibilities. So I hope I'm answering your question, but that was kind of my experience, that I learned that through the process, you know, people get excited about candidates and sometimes they really don't know how the process works, and I think it should be the other way around. You know, you get excited about the process and how it works and what it does for you, and then if, you know, you discover a candidate that you like, good for you. But it's kind of an incomplete process at this point.
We have testifiers that have signed up to testify. Yasin Ahmad. Mr. Ahmad, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To give you a short my background, I'm a teacher, ESL teacher. Also, I'm a life skills teacher. I was in this state for the last 7 years teaching here in ESL.
Could I have you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Yasin Ahmad. I'm a Somali community elder, teacher by ASL and life skills. And first of all, I'm glad that we are here today to testify the need of this community itself. For the last 6 years or 7 years, I was working on civic engagement for my community and life skills. By year 2004, there were 11,000 Somalis voted in this state, but with difficulty. 2006, there were about 15,000. Among all of those, 38% of the people who were voting were elders. 80% of those elders speak Somali language only. It became difficult to us, through motivation, to tell them the civil engagement and what's needed for the voting. And who's running? There are four people running for governorship. So you choose the one that you like. But to teach them, because in 1969, that was the last day that the people had voted in Somalia. 1972 was the period that the Somali language was adapted to be written officially. That's the only language they know. By 1990, a civil war has happened in Somalia. And from that day, they were in refugees until they came back to here and welcomed by this state. And they are very proud to be there in this state. Yet, apart of that, they need to learn, and they like to work with the communities that they are living together. They need to learn what's happening in the civic engagement. They need to learn the ballot, what's the processing of this, the difference between a ward, a prison, and everything. So the only way that we can tell them is through their languages. The young folks that we have, who has been here recently, has also difficult to tell something to their moms or to their fathers, because there's a lot of families here, single mother families. The only way that you can then tell something to the elders is to give them in their own language. Now, in my ESL class, there are about 1,000 students that passed me through that 5-6 years. I was translating from Somali to English to everything that they had. So the same thing, I traveled all the way to Wilmer, Mankato, everywhere, Marshall, St. Cloud, Rochester, everywhere, to those where the Somalis are. By the year, I say 2010, there will be 100,000 Somalis living here. And there will be a good number of Somalis who are voting. But what did they know about the vote? They need to know what's happening around them. They need to participate equal with other communities that they are in. And they are glad to be. Every information that we do here, we transfer to Ohio, to Seattle, to San Diego, where there's massive Somalis living to those pockets. But if you can imagine, also we send them back to Somalia, the information that we receive. To engage the people, democracy, to understand what's happening and to be proud of that. So the language is very important. very, very important to have translated languages, especially in the ballot box, papers, in every sort of things that's happening on the elections. So that's what's the need of the community on this issue. Because in the high rise of either in St. Paul or Minnesota, just in the Twin Cities, when you go there, people are tuned for something else. But when you mention to them and sit with them and explain to them why are they voting, what's the necessity of voting, then they are eagerly coming to the voting place. So I think there is a much need on this issue for translation. Otherwise, it's very difficult to tell what's happening to these people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ahmad. Mr. Cooper, did you have testimony?
Yes.
We'd be very, very brief.
Keep it brief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Scott Cooper with the Minnesota Voting Rights Coalition. And I would just like to add a few things to the testimony you've already heard and maybe try and address a couple of the questions that have come up in a different way, add additional information. We put this on our legislative agenda for the year because many of the organizations that participate in our coalition, nonprofit organizations, go out and do voter registration drives and voter mobilization drives in a nonpartisan way to try to get people involved in the political process. And just like Mr. Ahmad was saying, you go into communities where there are new Americans who have the right to vote and should be participating in our democracy, and we go and welcome them to participate. And in fact, many of our nonprofits that receive state grants are actually mandated by state law to register voters. And the former Secretary of State, and I'm sure our new Secretary of State will continue this practice, went out to citizenship ceremonies and tried to register people right there as they became citizens. So that's great, but we do face this language barrier where many people, even though they may speak English, feel most comfortable discussing complex issues in their native language. And some of our forms, unfortunately, are kind of complicated. Our voting rules, especially around things like election day registration, can be quite complicated. So we've started with some very simple proposals here about the voter registration application and your absentee ballot application and your absentee ballot, and just having those translated so that people can see what it is that they're actually swearing an oath to, that they are, in fact, swearing an oath when they sign a voter registration application, so they can understand clearly in their own language and the language they're most comfortable in, what it is that they are attesting to. So we think this is very important, that this will help a great deal. I should point out the question was raised, question about this was raised earlier. And there are you know, lots of efforts out there to go into people's communities with translated materials currently. And the nonprofit community often translates things and has them generated. Campaigns sometimes do. We have seen some materials translated, like the voter registration application has been translated in the past into other languages. But some counties have found it necessary on their own to go ahead and translate materials. And we believe that this, centralizing this in the Secretary of State's office just for the translation of these three forms, will probably save us some resources down the road because there will be only one person out there actually conducting the translation into any given language. We can all rely on the fact that it's accurate, that it's true, and then nonprofits can use it, government officials can use it, and we hope that it will then help in our efforts to get people to participate in civic life.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Is there further testimony from the public? Are there any Senator Rest?
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1651 be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 1651 be recommended to pass. All those in favor say
aye. This is a subcommittee.
Yeah. This will just pass to the full committee. Senator Rest's motion is before us that Senate File 1651 be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Torres.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr.
Senator Rest. Senate File 758.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 758 is designed to clarify the way in which organizations report lobbying expenditures. Last year, the Campaign Finance Board decided that nonprofit organizations needed to report lobbying to the legislature for or against the placement of of a constitutional amendment through political action funds instead of normal lobbying expenditures. And that became a problem for the 501c3s, who are totally tax-exempt organizations because they are prohibited from political activity, and they can't have PACs, and they were being forced to create them in order to meet this reporting requirement. And what we are proposing here is to allow them just to report once on lobbying for or against issues, and it be on their lobbying expenditure report rather than forcing them to have PACs. So that's what it's a fairly simple amendment to a current statute about ballot questions when they are lobbying about ballot questions. Ms. Avner is here to speak to the bill, answer questions, and among the organizations that do lobby on behalf of ballot questions, is my understanding they are all in support of this change to state law.
Ms. Avner, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Marcia Avner. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We would very much appreciate your support for this change. At the federal level, 501c3 organizations are allowed to lobby within limits, and that lobbying for IRS and other purposes is all reported as lobbying. The problem that we run into with work on constitutional ballot initiatives is that if they are interpreted to require reporting through a political action fund, that has a significant chilling effect on 501c3 organizations. We're not allowed to have PACs. We may create political action funds, but the reality is, for a nonprofit board of directors and for a nonprofit organization, the very thought of creating a political action fund would have a significant chilling effect. Our boards of directors would see this rightly as something that would trigger an IRS audit. We are not allowed to do anything that is partisan. And so what we're asking here is that when we are lobbying, using the rules definition of lobbying, when we are lobbying at the legislature, whether it is for a statutory change or to place something on the ballot or not place something on the ballot, that all of that be considered in the same way to be lobbying. Lobbying is lobbying. That would be consistent with the federal law, and it would apply during the legislative session. So I'm happy to try to answer any questions. It's a fairly simple but very important change. We do have broad support. Our organization has over 1,750 members. We've worked in consultation with the Family Council, MCCL, Outfront Minnesota, Minnesota Citizens for the Arts, the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, the groups that have tended to work on this in their C3 and sometimes their C4 capacity. And they're not only in agreement, but a few of them, especially the Family Council, would like us to go further and get this to apply all the way through November. But what we're asking is that during the legislative session, lobbying be reported as lobbying.
Thank you, Ms. Avner. Senator Gerlach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I see that 5 out of the 6 subcommittee members are co-authors on this, so I don't know if it's going to have any trouble or not. Move it along.
I think this one's ready to go. Senator Rest.
Wishes to speak to this bill.
Is there any member of the public that would like to address the bill? Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate file 75-8, and I want to make a comment about it, be recommended to pass. I do want people to notice that the effective date is retroactive January 1 of this year.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Rest moves that Senate file 758 be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rest.
Fine lobbying.
Okay.
Yes.
We now have Senate File 1558, Election Campaign Contributions Limits for Judicial Candidates. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1558 addresses an issue that...
Senator Larson, did you have an amendment?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment will put the bill in the shape that I would like to be in. I would move the A1 amendment.
Senator Larson moves the A1 amendment. All those in any discussion, all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Larson, to your bill, Senate File 1558.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, we in Minnesota do not have limits on contributions for candidates for judicial office. And this is not in response, this legislation is not in response to any particular circumstance other than a growing concern that really we ought to have some limits on contributions as we do in all other elections that we have, state elections that we have in Minnesota. And so what we have done with this and what the amendment accomplishes to provide the best, the most flexibility possible with some guidance from our current statute is to put the all judicial office candidates at the same contribution limits as candidates for governor. Which is $2,000 in an election year and $500 in other years. As we move forward with our elections, it just seems like a protection we ought to have in statute. And Ms. Olson from the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board also has some data that she can provide to the committee and perhaps some testimony regarding some of our history and issues that we've faced as it relates to this.
Ms. Olson, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, Jean Olson, Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Senator Larson asked Mr. Sigurdson to go and get this list, and this is a list of judicial candidates who have accepted over $2,000 in recent years, and we have about 60 contributions greater than $2,000 in the last few years. There's about 100 contributions, but the other 40 are from the candidate themselves. But the highest was $10,000 from an individual to a judicial candidate, and that wasn't an appeals or a Supreme Court. That was just a district court candidate. Most of the contributions that are over $2,000 are from political committees and funds and law firms and not from individuals.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak in favor or in opposition to this, to Senate File 1558? Mr. Cooper, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair and member of the committee, members of the committee, my name is Scott Cooper with the Minnesota Voting Rights Coalition, and I would like to speak in favor of this bill. I'd like to say a couple words to put this in context. Because in Minnesota, we have, it's true, not had a horrible problem with this in the past. We've had fairly reasonable judicial elections where generally the incumbents win. Generally, not a lot of money is raised. Generally, there's not a lot of special interest money. And generally, the campaigns are not particularly heated or visible. However, since the Supreme Court decision in White, it is permissible for candidates for judge to seek party endorsements and campaign with party endorsements, to campaign on issues that may appear before them in court, and to take money from people that may appear before them in court, all of which has people in the community, like our organizations, very, very concerned about what could happen with judicial elections. We've seen in many other states that don't have contribution limits and that have elections like our elections, we've seen very, very expensive, very, very contentious judicial elections. Illinois recently had its first $9 million district court race. With very heated TV ads, it looked very much like a congressional campaign, with candidates accusing each other of things and promising to deal with issues. We certainly don't want to see that here in Minnesota. Wisconsin recently took the attitude that they didn't need serious judicial reform because they were like us at the time, 4 years ago. They had very, very inexpensive elections, very, very uncontested elections. They recently saw their first district court race that cost $1.5 million. So it is a trend that is happening across the country in places like Minnesota where there are no protections against that sort of thing. We think that a very simple first step toward a solution is putting at least contribution limits on contributions to judicial candidates, and hope that you will agree.
Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Senate file 1558 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Larson moves that Senate file 1558 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Is Senator Marty coming up here?
Well,
that's the last bill.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And,
I'll present it for you.
Senator Marty is presenting a bill in Room 15. Okay. Steve is, our committee page has gone down to check, and we'll be back momentarily. If we can hang in there for just a second, and we'll have that information quickly.
If Senator Marty is not able to come at this time, I would be willing to have this bill heard in the full committee. That would then not necessitate another meeting of the subcommittee.
I think that's a good idea.
It's agreeable. Senator Gerlach.
Senator Gerlach, is that agreeable to you?
Yes, that's agreeable to me, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, is the easiest way to do that to just have you do it, or should we move without recommendation the bill to the committee?
No, I can just pull the bill back to the full committee.
Well, we can maybe give Steve 30 more seconds or to see if Senator Marty is available. But that,
maybe Ms. Schaefer Pellinen could go and let Senator Marty know that if he does need to stay there, that we will hear the bill in the full committee.
Thank you, Ms. Schaefer Pellinen.
I think that's the easiest thing to do.
Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman, just as long as we're waiting here, can you tell me, is this the last planned meeting of the election subcommittee then? Or
well, Senator Gerlach, I don't know that we have many other bills, and I have not entirely consulted with Senator Rest as to what the schedule will be like as we receive Senate files. And so I don't know.
House files.
Or I'm sorry, I'm still thinking from the other direction.
We would, you know, I think
Senator Rest.
Maybe Senator Gerlach, you and I and Senator Larson and Senator Lurie could have a brief meeting to decide whether we will send those bills down to the subcommittee and then back up again, or whether we will just take them up in the full committee. Let's see, the other...
Madam Chair, these would be the House files.
The House files.
That we haven't...
Where the House file was passed first.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I don't think that... Or one thing that we are not intending to do is to take up any constitutional amendments. Well, Senator Marty.
Senator Marty.
We were just agreeing that we would hear your bill in the full committee if you were not...
Oh, okay, but just presented some little bills, and I'm sorry that took so long.
That's okay.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, Senate file...
50.
Nice round number. Senate file 50 is a bill that is... come before the legislature a number of times in recent years. The House tried to do it in kind of a backwards way a few weeks ago by trying to amend their rules, which doesn't make much of a sense because this is something that affects former legislators and former constitutional officers and former commissioners and deputy commissioners. And this is simply a two-year, what some have called cooling-off period, revolving door legislation, where you would, when you leave the legislature or administrative position, you would not be able to return and lobby there for 2 years after leaving your office. And let me suggest that there is a lot of turnover in government, and two-year period is something that it breaks some of the ties that one has built up over the years. I think that those of us who have served here for a while, we get to know each other, we have different access. We actually leave our former colleagues, except when they become lobbyists, are allowed access to the floor. They have an inner, it's a different kind of relationship we have with former colleagues than with a typical person coming here to influence the legislature. And I think it's healthier if we have, there are plenty of other things we can go do when we leave the legislature. And I think it's healthy if we have a couple-year cooling-off period before you can leave the office, either, again, constitutional office or commissioner level. We didn't drop down below the deputy commissioner level, but you're running an agency. You shouldn't turn around and lobby. And I think we've seen that many times in the past. I have concerns of pollution control agency a few years ago took somebody who was working as a regulated industry, working with the pollution control agency, then takes over as head of the pollution control agency, then goes back to the industry to work with them again in a different lobbying kind of capacity. I think it's worth having a two-year cooling-off period. It doesn't mean it's not a lifetime ban, but it creates a little bit of a distinction, so you're not just going through the so-called revolving door. You go into the government and then out and turn around and try and influence people you were working with in the past. And I think it's important for state agencies. I think it's important for the legislature. And I don't think this is an onerous requirement. And a lot of states have done this. Federal government has some restrictions on it. This has been controversial in the past when it's come up, but I think this is a reasonably drafted thing that only hits those who are in higher level positions, and it's only for a two-year period.
Discussion.
Madam Chair, I think the legal and voters may have submitted a letter, but I'm not sure.
I don't know if do members have that letter?
No.
I do not.
I was told they had one, and I didn't get it today, so I assumed it may have been here. But
so, Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, do they support your position?
He does support the revolving door.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I've been attracted to this idea in the past as well. I'm not sure, and I think I'm going to offer an amendment to make it 1 year rather than two. I think 1 year accomplishes the same purpose, and I think that otherwise it looks to me to be really overbearing. So, Mr. Chairman, I move on line 1.9 to strike 2 years and insert 1 year.
Senator Rest moves on line 1.9 to strike 2 years and insert 1 year. Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I'd prefer 2 years, but again, I'd rather have one than none. We've had none for many years, and I know there's some other proposals that would have 1 year. So I'll oppose the amendment, but I'll still strongly support the bill with it on.
The motion is before us. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Marty, what about, when I was, there's probably two parts to this question. When I was elected in 1998, the person that I followed at the legislature was Representative Mark Mahon. And one of the things that he really found valuable and wanted to make a contribution in terms of public service beyond his service in the legislature was to become involved in a nonprofit organization and spent a lot of time at the legislature as a volunteer, but I believe met the qualifications as a lobbyist because of the time that he spent lobbying What about a case like that? Representative Mann would have been not permitted to engage in that activity.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Counsel can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a few years ago we changed the definition of a lobbyist from one that spent so many hours here. So a purely volunteer person who was not compensated for coming here was not covered under the definition. And I can't remember what year that was, whether it's 2 years ago or when, but 2 or 3 years ago. But we did. I believe we changed it so a volunteer would not be covered as a lobbyist.
We do have that fixed. Okay. Well, thanks, Senator Marty. The other question is, frankly, from some members who, and as I, when I came to the legislature in 98, I came from my previous job had been as a lobbyist. And it's not my intention when I leave the legislature to lobby, although I guess one never knows. But I know that a number of members have served had been in that occupation prior to their service, and upon leaving, perhaps have considered that they might go back to their previous occupation, and this, of course, would not permit that. Is there an unfairness in that, or how do you feel about that?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with somebody who is petitioning government and they decide they want to get involved in government, they run for office, get elected. I don't think we could or should try to regulate that. The voters choose who they want to put in office. But going back to it again, they've picked up certain access. I've gotten calls from some former colleagues who I didn't know were even lobbying, and you kind of, oh, so-and-so, representative so-and-so, and you talk to them because you assume they want to do it. Then you find out they're lobbying for something, and it's a different kind of connection, different kind of relationship, and again, I think at least allow a year cooling-off period so that people know they left the place. I mean, I still see some House members. I thought, are they still in the House? I thought they left, and let's at least make sure we know they're out the door before we have them back in. I realize if somebody was doing that, if you were doing it beforehand and going back, you couldn't go back to the same job, at least for a period of time.
And Senator Marty, one of the jokes in the lobbying community I know when I was lobbying was that oftentimes the least effective lobbyists are members right after they leave the legislature. They find it awkward. They don't like to lobby.
They're
the
issues.
They and so I'm not sure that we're accomplishing what your goal is here, because I know, well, Mr. Hench, well, I won't ask Mr. Henches to comment on that, but I know that oftentimes folks believe that was those were the least effective lobbyists. But anyway, is there any further discussion? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple things. I'm just wondering, if we don't have this exit strategy, then how are we ever going to get rid of all the dead weight around here? So we'll worry about that. I have mixed feelings about this. In fact, someone asked me about this before the committee, and I thought, yes, it makes a great idea, great sense. And then as I've been around here more, I'm not so sure. Now, I have no intention of lobbying, but I noticed that all of the co-authors are all freshmen on the bill. And wide-eyed and eager young freshmen on that as co-authors. But I'm not sure what problem this bill is attempting to solve, other than sort of a maybe there's a public perception it's trying to get at, maybe try to boost the ratings of the people's view in the legislature. But I just don't know what problem it's trying to solve. I heard your explanation of the bill, but again, I'm not sure. One of the things too is that I think that it's built on a premise that lobbying is a dishonorable profession. That if someone is a lobbyist, I mean, I look at them as free staff. I don't share the view that lobbyists are all bad. I might joke about it with other people and such. Maybe that's bad because it helps perpetuate the premise or the stereotype. But I think that something like this just leads to that it's a leads to furthering the premise that it's a dishonorable profession. And the example you gave was about a corporate lobbying, with the PCA example, but Senator Larson brings up a good point. Nonprofits, there's a lot of people that want to continue to be involved in the issues they're passionate about here and may not get paid a whole lot, and they're in a nonprofit world. I hate to dry up the labor pool for Marcia as well, possibly. So anyway, that's just kind of my statements in general, rhetorical. I guess you don't have to respond to all of those if you don't want to. But I do have one specific question, and that is, if this is one year, do we have to then fire any current lobbyists that have come on board different firms or organizations in the last year? Because it doesn't say, I mean, it's effective August, but I'm just trying to wonder if there was anybody that has to quit, if this catches anybody in a net like that. That's the specific question I have for
Senator Marty. Mr. Chairman, the specific question first. I don't picture it would. It wasn't intended to, and I'm not trying to get people fired who have jobs right now. I think it should be prospective in terms of people who would leave the legislature after that, and if it does require an effective date to do that, I would gladly support that. To your other points, which you said I don't have to address, but I'd like to, one of which is public perception. I don't think we should do things primarily because of public perception. My issues in terms of changing how we relationships of money and politics and lobbying and legislative stuff and so on is not something that we should be jumping to fix problems with public perception. If there's a problem with public perception that's an inaccurate public perception, we should do the PR to fix the problem, the perception problem. I think there is a substantive issue here, though, and again, in terms of lobbying being a dishonorable profession. No, I mean, part of our whole system is that people have a right to petition their government. You can do it. I can do it. We can get together as a group of us and ask somebody to do it for us for convenience sake or whatever. We can even pay them to do so. I don't have a problem with that. My goal has always been to make sure we have that the process works based on lobbyists providing useful information and providing in a fair, equitable manner. In terms of one of the reasons I spend a lot of time on what some would call restrictions on lobbying, and I don't bash lobbyists. I try and distinguish the former governor said he wouldn't meet with lobbyists. I've never said anything of the sort and never don't believe that myself. I don't think it's a dishonorable profession. What I'd like to see us have is a system where people lobby and they win on the merits of their argument, not based on the fact in the past the ability to provide food and beverages, not based on campaign contributions, not based on the fact that they have prior ties to us from serving as our colleagues. The goal would be that we have that issues have their chance to be heard in front of the legislature in a fair manner. And the fact that we may be more desirable for some business or some entity to hire to come here and lobby our colleagues, I don't think that's an advantage that we should be conferring on some group or whatever. And I don't think it's such a onerous restriction on us to have us not do that for a couple years or 1 year now. But it's not, again, the fact that I've tried hard to ban, I mean, I still support banning paid lobbyists from giving us campaign contributions. We've decided it was not a good thing during the session. I think it should be year-round. And that's not to say anything against lobbyists or the people who take it, the contributions or the ones who give them. It's to say that we just make the process more on the merits of the argument, not based on other connections that we make here.
Is there anyone in the public that would like to testify on Senate File 50? Is there any further discussion? Senator Marty, would you be open to for the conversation to continue forward? Would you be comfortable with a motion that included no recommendation to continue to have the conversation? And
Mr. Chairman, we used to have a tradition in the Senate that we didn't kill bills in subcommittee, and so we allow them to pass out one way or another. I'd prefer a recommendation. I'd choose to do that, but if the subcommittee would feel more comfortable without that, I'd like to be able to continue moving if it's possible. That way would be fine, too.
Senator Murdy moves Mr. Watson, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, you'd indicated an interest in an effective date?
Yes, to make sure it applies to people leaving the legislature after the date of
or
this.
Or any of these other.
After what date? August 1 or the date of enactment or July 1? Or
sure, after date of enactment. I don't think it matters a whole lot, but I don't know anybody who's planning to leave the legislature midterm to go lobby.
But it applies to others, too, like deputy commissioners and so forth. Right. So you do have to have a...
Okay, well, let's do it day after enactment.
So,
Mr. Watson.
The language would be page 1, after line 12, insert section 2, effective date. This act is effective the day following final enactment and applies to individuals who leave an office or position after that date.
Solved. Does everyone have that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So then that would solve the retroactivity problem.
Yes.
We wouldn't have to fire anybody.
Right.
Very good. Does everyone have Senator Marty's motion, as stated by Mr. Watson? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Marty moves that Senate File 50 pass without recommendation. Is there further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator. There being no further business before the subcommittee, meeting is adjourned.